I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Matthew Gemello, a partner at Oric in the Bay Area, who leads the firm's global corporate business unit. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, David. Delighted to be here.
We're going to talk about several things on today's podcast. First, a little about your background, how you came to the law and developed the practice you have. Then we're going to focus on how you see law firms developing in the years that come, a subject you think about a lot given your role at Oric, and also one that's related to return to the office, which of course remains a subject of intense debate at many law firms. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to become a lawyer.
Happy to. And I guess I'd start by saying I'm happily married with two kids, and I live in Redwood City, California, which is very close to our office in Menlo Park. I'm a fourth generation resident of this county, which makes me a bit of a unicorn in some different ways. Thinking about my career, David, if you were to maybe try to figure out today how the path went, it might look a little more linear and thoughtful and intentional than it actually was. If I'm dreadfully honest, I kind of backed into it. I had started in as a young man and a young college student, kind of pre-med, based on a grandfather that I idolized. I hit a point, and I believe it was in hearing the head of the biology department say, this is a weeding out class for pre-med students. And I think the third time I heard that, a light bulb went on, and I don't think this is going to stick. So I looked around and tried to figure out what to do. And I had a mother who was a lawyer, a bit of a North Star for me professionally. And I decided law school was an easy way to go to kind of keep the friction at the parent level down by an extended collegiate run. Didn't know much about corporate law. And if I thought about it today, I would tell you that I managed to pick a career that fits well with some of my strengths, but I don't know that it was that intentional at the end of the day.
And so talk a little bit about the start of your career, how your experiences there shape how you think about managing now and how you relate to associates?
It's a great question. I was really fortunate in that I had a mentor right out of the gate, someone who almost adopted me as a summer associate. And I should start by saying I started my career in a relatively small, by today's standards, 100-person firm, corporate and litigation split between San Jose and San Francisco. My mentor at the very beginning asked me, kind of without challenging, how serious do you take this? And I was gung-ho at that point and said, I'm going to take it pretty seriously. And with the benefit of hindsight now, I see that I got so much leash at a young age, so much leash, much of which was earned through trust and developing that relationship with the partner who ultimately was my mentor for most of my career. But really, it was the opportunities and the sponsorship, if you will, that he gave me, allowing me to kind of step into those roles. So as a young lawyer, kind of getting thrown into the pool, without much of a safety net, you learn quickly what works and what doesn't. And I think my North Star throughout my career has always been thinking about the client experience, really optimizing the service that we're providing them, which is tricky when you're a young lawyer because you don't really know what's going on in the big picture. But it was those opportunities and those reps. I talk a lot with our team about the development path and how you always want to be going up and to the right rather than flatlining. So we hit a level of, okay, I'm the master of this domain. I don't want to stay comfortable for long. I want to challenge myself and keep going. And I think that's been something that allowed for maybe a career development that was a little accelerated relative to peers. But again, it starts with the opportunities I was given. And I had to earn them, but I'm very cognizant that you can perform well in the right situation, in the right kind of circumstances. And I was blessed in that I had a protective net. I had a partner who trusted me and gave me the opportunity to kind of step into that for, which is a, now looking back, it's a tricky thing to do as a mentor. You know, you got to give up some control. And we corporate lawyers are wired a certain way from a type A perspective. And just that kind of human element of seeding the calm, if you will, to the next gen was something that was transformative for me along my path.
You said your mentor asked you how serious you were. And you said, I'm serious about this. But of course, as a summer associate or a first year, unless that person has a parent or parents who do something pretty similar to what the person, him or herself, is doing, that person doesn't really know what serious means in this context. So How do you deal with that as a manager where, you know, maybe the first even couple of years, especially for lawyers who have gone straight from college to law school, you're working with someone who's really figuring out what the expectations and demands of the profession are.
Yeah. And I mean, we can have a separate podcast with lots of drinks about how poorly law school does from a training perspective for corporate lawyers and the basic skill sets you need. But you nailed it, David. I mean, you show up on the first day and you have no clue largely what's going on unless you had prior experience to see it. I think from a leadership perspective, I personally, and we tend to over-index on those traits that are almost markers for high performers, a degree of responsibility and responsiveness, a sense of accountability. And I think when we start to see those traits in our younger lawyers, or some maybe rising a little more quickly than others, we double down on them and take advantage of it. I think, to be totally candid, we collectively on the leadership side in the industry need to do a better job about being more direct, more transparent about career path, about how hard it is, about where the bumps might come and the challenges might come, but also empowering the younger associates to take control of their situation. Control is relative, obviously, within the macro, but to be proactive, to seek out advice and feedback, to ask questions like, what do I need to do to get in that room? You know, there was an element, and I don't want to carbon date myself as to when I started, but there was an element of associates kind of quiet, sat in their office, did what were asked, didn't really ask too many questions. But that's not where we are today. This is a moment for younger lawyers, I think, to have some degree of control over at least their own career path from an accountability perspective, rather than getting whipsawed by an institution. And I think that's been a big change. We look for those traits and we encourage people to talk about them and articulate them, because that's very real to us in terms of everybody's development along a particular path.
Well, and to what extent do your associates now almost expect that, A, they're going to have a greater level of control over their careers, and B, that, you know, they walk in with the idea that over a 40 to 50 year career, they may have 10 jobs, which obviously still isn't the model on which law firms are premised. I mean, the ideal is still you walk in at 25 or however old you are, and you walk out 40 years later, having spent your career at one firm. It never happened a lot, but it remains the ideal.
Yeah, in theory, that is the ideal. Now, the reality, and this is not necessarily that a lot of law firm partners want to hear, most of the folks that join a law firm, if they were honest, don't want to matriculate to partnership, or at least that's not their goal, maybe with the same conviction that a new associate in the 80s or the 90s might have had. So that's one piece of it. There's also a tremendous amount of career flexibility and nimbleness. And the new and evolved law firm is having engaged conversations with its young lawyers about what they want to do, where they want to land, how they're thinking about their own career development. And candidly, the firms should lean in about the training that's necessary, right? I mean, it's mutually beneficial for us if we can help a young associate get some training and then go to an in-house position. I mean, that's business development 101. But I think being direct and transparent about it is something that is one of the biggest changes that I've seen during my career. I'll give you a perfect example. I stand up at group meetings when I talk to practices and I say, if you don't want to be a partner here, that's totally great. Tell us early, and we're going to figure out a way to kind of customize your development path so that you can get the skill training that you need to be successful. But that rote sense of I'm starting and I'm going to die in the chair and I'm going to take every promotion or demotion that comes with it, I mean, that's not the norm that we live in anymore. And candidly, we want to encourage our people to be nimble in terms of how they think about their career and their career trajectory. Big law, corporate, is an amazing place to start for a whole bunch of interesting job potentials outside of the law or outside of law firms. And I think people kind of coming in with a proactive sense of where they want to go, even if they don't have the end game in mind, but they know what they like to do and what they're good at, I think that becomes an increasingly relevant data point in the conversation about career and career trajectory.
But part of the challenge is at 25, they may not know what they want to do or what they're good at. They certainly in a professional context may very well not know what their strengths and weaknesses are. It may take people a while to figure that out.
Yeah, totally fair. And I'd love to see us as an industry, and we're certainly doing some things in internally at Oric that are a little more guidelined with apprenticeship models, where you actually get to kind of let me watch and see literally what you do every day for a year and a half or for 6 months or whatever it is, so I can get a sense of that. That's part of it, the education piece. But it's also incumbent on firms and the leaders of the firm to develop opportunities for young lawyers to flex those muscles and to see, hey, do I like the task of speaking to a large group of people? Do I like the counseling relationship that exists, you know, say with an emerging company founder and a lawyer? Do I like doing that kind of banter? I, for one, gravitated more to bigger institutions, to more formality around things. And you just learn that as you go. But when you hear me use the words like people need to be proactive for their own career, there's never been an opportunity like there is today for young lawyers to have a seat at the table as their firm tries to figure out what the next 5 or 10 years is going to look like. I mean, this is a moment unlike any that we've ever seen. There is a massive commercial pressure on the business model, the historical business model. You've got technology coming that arguably is going to make a number of our team obsolete from a human perspective and from terms of what they're doing. And so the ability to kind of take control or at least have some active voice in your own career trajectory is something that we're just encouraging and championing. And when we see those kinds of positive behaviors from our team, we lean into them because it's a moment. And you see that moment, David, of they might not know where they want to go, but there is almost a binary flip of, I'm not going to get told where I'm going. I want to have some say in that direction. And that's the unique moment of where we are right now, you know?
You talk about lawyer tasks that may become obsolete, but even over the last 20 years, you've seen a number of tasks that lawyers historically did or paralegals did that have become obsolete. I mean, on the litigation side, discovery is massively different than it used to be. Obviously, on the corporate side, due diligence. You know, nobody for probably 20 plus years or very few people have redlined documents. And that was a staple of the corporate work 70s, 80s, you know, 90s, really before word processing. So it's the profession actually has evolved significantly over the course of the time you've been practicing. And so how do you look back at that? And what do you learn from it as you look at the next, say, 10 years in big law?
Good question. I think I draw a distinction between some of that innovation that has happened prior to today. Probably the single biggest one that I would focus on is the one you nailed, which is the e-discovery piece and how firms are dealing with that. The rest of it is largely unspectacular. And to a true innovative mind would look back and kind of say like, huh, that's innovative. But today, right now, whether it's, you know, coming out of the heels of a global pandemic that really changed the way the world interrelated, you saw massive uptick in just municipal, national, global kind of quasi-governmental and regulatory regimes that popped up, right? I mean, so we're at a unique moment and is facing a crisis that it's never faced. Tech's not the golden child that it was in history. And so this moment is crystallizing in a different way. We undoubtedly will continue to listen to our clients and take direction from our clients in terms of where we shape the business. But we're not alone in thinking this way at Oric, but we have completely embraced the fact that it is a massively disruptive and choppy market right now. And the firms that are able to kind of chart the path of how they're going to continue to evolve their service offerings are the ones that are going to be successful. For us, it's about investing in the individuals. This whole game, as we move forward, is going to be a talent and data play. I think the ability to discharge the transaction, to try the case, that's going to table stakes across our firms. And obviously, some are better than others at different things. But the quality of the service has to be at a premium. It's how and who. And I think those are the two pieces that make me particularly excited as we think about the evolution of that going forward. It presents a really unique moment for lawyers to have an opportunity to kind of catapult themselves forward, embracing a new way of engaging with clients, embracing new technologies and new efficiencies that drive the interrelation. But it ultimately is going to come down to human interaction. So it's kind of a funny one where the innovation piece is coming massively. There's disruption to the model, the historical model, but it's going to be, at least my personal view, and I think our thesis here, is that it's increasingly going to be the human pieces of it, the human interaction and the human development that's going to drive that, notwithstanding all of the tech and all of the AI and everything else that's coming. You know, our clients told us over and over and over again during the last 3 years, I need help. I don't understand this maze of things that is coming out. It's a different environment that I'm used to behaving in. I understand my business, but there's all kinds of attacks, whether they're competitive, whether they're just evolutionary to the business from the edges. And we need help kind of seeing around corners as we think about that. That piece, that human partnership that comes from it, which is ultimately the core of every counseling relationship, is something that we're indexing on and quadrupling down on. I want our young lawyers out talking to clients, bringing their true authentic self in a way that allows humans to connect, to develop that trust, because that trust is the most fundamental underpinning of the service relationship.
Obviously, there's been an unbelievable amount of dialogue about what the law firm office is going to look like, how the individuals in the institution are going to relate to one another. Like, is that going to happen in physical space? Or how much of that is going to happen in physical spaces? How much of it happens in physical spaces once a year at group retreats? What's your take on it? And how does that answer differ? I mean, obviously, Oric, you're an international firm. You know, how does that answer differ depending on whether, say, you're in the Bay Area or Texas or London?
I think there's some universal truths that we can draw from. And when we think about our teams, I'm less worried about the client-facing teams because they're already engaged. They're already interacting. They're already kind of coming together and solving, replacing, evolving, whatever you want to call it, from how we deliver service. The piece that troubles me, and I think for anybody that has practiced for, say, in the last 10 years, you started your practice, we learned at the feet of others. We learned at the sitting in an office, listening to senior lawyers, talk to clients, negotiate deals, deal with bills, deal with all kinds of things. And we watched and learned. And that was often just very opportunistic. Hey, David, come in my office. I'm on a call. I want you to listen to this conversation. So it was those kind of serendipitous interactions, those bumping into each other in a physical way that sparked, honestly, true innovation, right? It was two, at the most core level, two people coming together to collaborate and coming up with an idea of how to do something. We have to figure out a way to replicate that. And I don't know how we're going to do it, if I'm totally honest. And we're still working through it as a firm. But a piece that we don't want to lose is the brilliance that comes from just literally the basic interaction between two humans. And if we do it in a technology setting or we do it in a combination of ways, I don't know. But this is the moment to kind of start to think about that. And so what I'd say, maybe just as my, if you could give me this plug to the young lawyers out there, don't let this moment pass if you'd like to have a seat at the table. Every firm is going to deal with it differently, but we're asking about ideas and how to engage and what works and what doesn't. And someone who's closer to 25 or 30 might have a lot more practical ways of interacting than somebody at my age at the other end of that spectrum. So it'll be fascinating to see as we go. But that's the uniqueness, is we have to figure out a new toolkit. All the tools that we used to have to train people, to develop, to help skills develop, to bring people together, to produce good stuff for clients, we have to figure out other ways to do that now. And that's going to be the tricky thing. And I think we're all struggling with it, you know?
How do you think your associates now are different from the associates that you would have had maybe 10 or 15 years ago, or than your age cohort was when they were associates?
Well, I think certainly there was an element of my generation, and just to contextualize it, I got out of school in 97, that I think carried forward what a lot of people, prior generations, might have done, which is it boils down to, thank you, sir, can I have another? I'm going to run as long and hard as you need to. So durational stability is a key component here, and just an ability to continue to work and to grind and to grind and to grind with the head down. I didn't do any of the things that I'm talking about today in terms of being really proactive with my own career development. I was blessed in that I had a mentor / Sherpa who helped me figure it out along the way, but I didn't get wired that way. Fast forward to today, young associates and new joiners are coming to us with such a broader perspective on the world, just given the massive increased information flow. They're usually more well-rounded, I think, on average, than people maybe 20, 25 years ago that were coming into law firms. We have a very real focus on work-life balance and wellness, which I don't think was something that we might have given lip service to in the 90s, but we certainly weren't changing the way we operated to take those things into account. So
but there was there's a pressure on this generation that, frankly, in the 90s didn't exist because you could genuinely unplug. You might not have been able to do that very often, but, you know, 97, 98, that's before law firms used email aggressively. It's obviously before smartphones. It's when people still really came to offices to do most of their work, almost all of it. None of those is true today.
No. And I mean, you nailed it. I'll give you one example that is so crystallized in my brain. When I started my career, we would mail documents out to investors on Friday. It would be whole office production. You know, secretaries come together, we just hard pack. And you had this moment, David, where you knew that you weren't getting a call until Monday morning because of the way the FedEx worked. September 14th, I went back and looked, 1998, I sent out my first set of documents on a Friday night by email. I got home and I had a comments back from an investor. And I remember sitting there thinking, huh, something's changed right here. And those cycles have only gotten worse. So, you know, I think for today's young lawyer managing just the crush of stuff that's coming at them, personal, professional, all of it, that's one of the hardest challenges. Is it's not cutting the wheat from the chaff. It's more just figuring out your path of how you're going to manage that maze. And it's different for everybody. And we don't try to prescribe a one size fit all. We put an offering of things out there for our people to kind of glom onto and help them along the way. But it's really a personal journey. And I think it takes a lot more intentionality than it might have certainly 10 or 15 years ago.
So to turn to traits you see in your associates now, clearly work-life balance, in part just because there is no off switch for either one. I mean, you know, you've got your phone, someone, a client can text you or email you, and any one of your acquaintances can do the same, and it comes to the same device, potentially at the same moment.
Yeah. Personally, I've struggled with that line. I grew up in a world where I like to shut down at some point and be done, even if it's for a short period of time and then pick it up the next day. And that's just tricky to do in today. So it requires a fair amount of discipline and rigor in terms of how you're going to organize yourself. Reference this a few times and I'll come back to it again. The core of this endeavor is a human exercise. And there was a period, and if there was silver lining or one small silver lining from the shelter in place and the pandemic, it was this element of the humanity that we bring to bear didn't need to be hidden behind a blurred out Zoom screen. Undoubtedly, clients were less comfortable with kids walking through cameras like after a few months, but there was an element of like, this is real life and you're fitting this job into your life and you don't need to mask that. And so I triple down on that and say to people, like, that's why you need to bring your full authentic self to the job. That's why you need to put it out there for a client, not airing your dirty laundry, but just being human so that there's a connection that can be developed. Because the way I get through it, and I appreciate, David, that I'm at a different level of seniority than a lot of junior associates, but I'm trying to be as transparent with clients on literally the timing. Hey, got your note. We're jamming on something else. We're going to get back to you by this point. But communicating in a way that gives us some space and gives us the time to get things done, it doesn't work every time. And sometimes you have to respond immediately. But I think just being more human in the interaction create some of that space. And again, it doesn't work everywhere because some clients don't want to hear it. But we're pushing that and pushing our teams to not bury the personal stuff, to not bury the personal interest, to not bury the true self, but to figure out a way to amplify it. It doesn't need to be the primary projection, but you know, it's totally fair, I think, for you to get on the phone and for a client to understand that maybe you had to drop a kid at school before you took this call, or maybe you're not available from 5 to 6 because that's dinner or something along those lines. I get we don't help as law firms from an economic perspective, from a cost that the client has to bear for the service. But I do believe that there is an element of humanity that needs to come back into this, just so that on a core human level, we can acknowledge that you're helping me and I'm paying you to do that. I get that. But it's not a rote thing. It's not a machine that pops it out. There is a human piece here. And I feel like that's just something we can't lose. I get asked a lot, David, best advice you ever received? It's be nice. Honestly, it's just be nice. And I think if I don't want to kumbaya out and say, we're all going to kind of hold hands and figure out a way to make this happy. But I do think there's an element of civility and personal respect that needs to come back into the profession a little bit. And it translates in a way that hopefully empowers our younger set of lawyers rather than making them feel like cogs in a machine or that they're just on a conveyor belt without much control about where they're going.
So does that really push them to interact with clients face-to-face, interact with their other lawyers face-to-face? Because it is massively easier to be unpleasant on an email or a text or a Slack message than it is even when you're talking to someone on the phone, let alone when you're face-to-face.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, for me, face-to-face is always the best. But if we're going to do something not face-to-face, then you're on camera. Even if you're not ready or not presentable or dealing with real life, I find that that is, if the quality of the lawyering is there, clients will forgive the extra stuff. It's when they think the extra stuff is precluding or limiting or blocking the advice that they start to react negatively, which is why it all comes back to transparency for us. But you nailed it, David. I mean, I love and I get super inspired by our team when I see junior lawyers taking some element of control over their life, asking for opportunities and demonstrating that they're putting in the time, the requisite time, so that they're going to do it well. It might not be perfect. And that's one of the hardest things from a mentoring perspective is just giving license to that mentee to do something because I can do it better than they can. I mean, that's just the reality of it. But it doesn't work if I just keep doing it. And so that kind of human relationship on the mentor-mentee side is pretty key. But it's why you'll hear me championing being proactive and taking control, because this is the moment for, if you're going to be quiet, sit at your desk with your head down, you're going to miss a whole bunch of stuff and possibly miss the boat, to be totally candid. But if you're up with your eyes open, being attentive, it just, you can see those opportunities and candidly it lines itself up for it's a much better career. Our star associates, David, are running deals by the time they're second years and third years. And they're leading client conversations. They might not be presenting to boards of directors, but they're materially impacting and delivering the high value that the client sees. Not great, you know, they toiled in the salt mine and produced the work product. They're actually here advising. I did a public deal earlier this year that ultimately didn't go for the right reasons. We had a fourth year associate who's one of our rock stars presenting to the board about the deal, about the agreement, about the approach we're taking. That lack of a ceiling, to me, remembering back to where I was, that's incredibly inspiring. Because I think if we were going to draw some assumptions across the young talent pool coming into big law, whether they want to be partners, whether they want to do this long term, they want reps and they want opportunities, right? So that's what they're getting, right? They didn't come here to work in the back office. And so our ability to put them in that position, if we see, we try to bring this out, but if we see any of those positive attributes, we want to amplify them. Create a safe environment, amplify them so people can just grow and develop.
And then finally, talk a little bit about how you decompress from work and how your own life experiences kind of affect how you look at being a manager and a mentor.
Yeah, it's a great question. And in the beginning of my career, I tried very hard to keep the work and the personal life separate. And I felt, perhaps foolishly, that was just a bit of an arbitrary line, but that would allow for balance. Now, what I didn't plan for is the fact that you think about things all the time, even if you're not working. So you need to kind of manage that. I guess, David, if I had to describe my own personal like life plan or that ideal to manage this, it probably has a couple key attributes. I believe I'm self-aware and I spend a lot of time, and my team will mock me for this, but I zoom out and I zoom in and I always try to take a step back, like, where am I in the scheme of things in the near term from a workflow, life events? How am I going to optimize my mindset for the task that needs to come? So that's a piece of it. I over-organize, which I think, again, you don't have to be as type A as some of us are, but just being thoughtful about what's coming and trying to plan and think about it, because so much of a corporate lawyer's life is, I hate to say it this way, just a massive project management exercise. But the real thing I think that's key is you have to find an outlet that brings you peace, and not peace in the sense that the world's going to get along, but just allows your brain and your being to settle and to kind of, and again, some high intensity people, their settling might still be a level higher than where I am after a bunch of venti coffees in the morning. But I think it's that ability for your brain to kind of check out and self-heal that is critically important. For me, I'm blessed in that my family is that anchor for me. I made the smart decision of marrying a Canadian woman back in the day, and we escaped to the mountains, and that's my happy place, and such that I get out winter or summer, smell the air, and I can take my brain to another place in a way that allows me to calm down. It's something that I'm very intentional about, and it's work. Don't get me wrong. It's not something that I let happen by natural flow. I kind of force myself to regulate where my psyche is at all the time. And so I guess long-winded way of saying, be cognizant of your own self and think about yourself from the inside and the outside, and just ensure that what you're doing allows you to recharge, not what someone else says this is the way to recharge, because for everybody it's unique. But if you can get to that point where there's peace, I think it allows you to kind of get the regenerative energy that you need to kind of come back to make sure you're bringing your best self the next day.
Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
David, it was my absolute pleasure. I look forward to continuing the conversation with you at some point in the future. Take care.
Thanks again. For Drinks with the Deal, I'm David Marcus.